Daniel 2, 20 and 21. Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belongs wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding." And thus far, the reading of God's word. 4 points to this sermon on the book of Daniel. They are the period of time, the purpose, the parts, and the points of application, three of which will be our points we have gone through in every book of the Bible, and that is, where do we see God's Christ and the gospel in the book of Daniel? Where do we see covenant in the book of Daniel? And where do we see missions in the book of Daniel? And then there are some other points of application as well. So period, purpose, parts, and points of application. For those of you that are visiting with us for the first time, we've been going through every book of the Bible, one sermon on each book, and we have been following a broad outline of the Bible, and it can be summarized in these six pictograms, if you will. The Bible tells one story about one people of God and one way of salvation. We have creation in the first vertical arrow down, fall in the X, Israel in the horizontal line, then Jesus Christ, then the church, and then Christ's return to judge the living and the dead. When Christ returns, it will be the end. It will be to judge the living and the dead. And we've been going through every book of the Bible in somewhat summary fashion. But allow me to begin by asking you a few questions. How would you live if you were in exile? I realize it's hard. We're not specifically in exile. But how would you live if you were in exile? If you were Judah in exile, how would you practice your faith if it was illegal? How would you practice your faith if the authorities were hostile to you? And even worse, you are in that situation because God is judging you for your sins, and you may never be any different than you are now. Well, that's the book of Daniel. And we want to look at the period of time, the purpose for which Daniel has written this book, its parts, and then these points of application. First of all, the period of time. Brief review here. The 10 northern tribes of Israel were carried away by whom? Assyria. What year? 722 BC. Judah, the remaining two tribes, southern tribes of Israel, are carried into exile by whom? Babylon. What year? 586. Very good. All right. There are actually three stages of exile. It began in 605. Probably that's when Daniel was taken away to exile. So we could say when Daniel is writing, it's from 605 BC to 536 BC. All right. Just if you're interested in historical markers there. He writes during the reign of four rulers, Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar in Babylon, and then Medo-Persian rulers Cyrus and Darius, all right? And it's important to note the period of time because there are valuable lessons here to be learned from them, then, and there, for you and me in a period of time which I believe is not very far away from us. While we may not be in exile, and while no nation is in the same situation as national Judah, the tribes of Judah that we come upon in the Bible, I believe that dark times lie ahead and that judgment is racing towards us as a nation. And it may not be far before we find ourselves in very similar circumstances to how the Israelites found themselves here. So there are valuable lessons to be learned. But secondly, what's the purpose for which Daniel writes this book? What's the purpose for which Daniel writes this book? Well, He writes to demonstrate that God's kingdom, now remember, he's writing to Judah in exile. And he writes to them to demonstrate that God's kingdom will conquer and outlast all other kingdoms. God's kingdom will conquer and outlast all other kingdoms. And of course, this truth was to assure the exiles that God was in control of history. And look at our text, chapter 2, verse 21. He, that is, God, changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. This is evident in the very first book, verse of the book. Turn to chapter 1 and verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim into his hand. God is the one who is in control. God was the one that was in control of the exiles. God was the one in control of the king of Judah and the king of Babylon. And the book repeatedly emphasizes the sovereignty and power of God over human affairs. And it highlights, underscores, and demonstrates that God has not deserted his people despite their being in exile. And therefore, because he has not deserted them, because he is in control of history, because his kingdom will conquer and outlast all other kingdoms, his people must continue to trust him. God is, God has been, and God always will be in control of all things. From the sparrow that falls from the tree and the number of the hairs on your head to the appointing of the populations of the earth and to the raising up and bringing down of rulers. Something to keep in mind in this election season. And if, as I surmise and speculate, that dark days lie ahead for the Church of Jesus Christ, that is for you and for me, then the purpose of this book for you and me here and now is that we might learn to trust him in all things and to be faithful in all things. Look then with me at the parts of Daniel. There are two main sections or divisions of the book of Daniel, chapters 1 through 6 and chapters 7 through 12. Chapters 1 through 6 record for us faithful living in evil times. Faithful living in evil times. And chapters 7 through 12, the second part, is forward looking in evil times. Forward looking in evil times. God's people must live faithfully and look forward in hope while waiting for God to bring down the godless kings of this world and establish his king and his kingdom. Now, let's look first of all at the first section, chapters 1 through 6. All right? There are six narratives here. Very interesting. In each chapter, the king, that is the pagan king, confesses that the God of the Jews is really God and is to be praised. Remember, Israel's in exile under pagan rulers. And in each chapter, we have a pagan king confessing that the God of the Jews is really God and is to be praised. This is amazing. Let's look at just scantily going over this. Chapter 1, some verses here. Follow me or just listen if you prefer. Verse 4, Daniel is taken to Babylon along with his friends, right? And verse 4, indoctrination begins to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. You want to erase a people's identity? Get them to lose their language. That's what's going on here. And then in verse 7, They give them new names, new identities. Daniel is Belteshazzar, Hananiah, and you know these names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So the indoctrination is going on of the Israelites so that they lose their identity, new names, new language, new literature, etc. All right? Verse 9. God gave Daniel favor. Very important. If I could relate to you something of a personal testimony, looking back on my own history, even before I was converted, I can look at points in my life and I can say, God gave me favor with certain individuals. So I got a good job, or I got a good placement, or I got a good income or something. God did that, even when I was an unbeliever. And here we see God. God's in control. Here, the Babylonians are seeking to do something. But what's God doing? God gave Daniel favor. Let's read on. Verse 17. They're being tested, right? And they have to have a special diet, right? And as for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And then verse 9. And the king spoke with them. Among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king, and in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. Isn't that a valuable lesson for education of covenant youth today? Covenant youth should surpass and excel in all matters, so that covenant youth, Christian children, are the ones who are the standouts. Christian children are the ones who are the best students, the ones who have excelled in their studies. And those of you that are students, boys and girls, listen to me. You have a job. Your job is like my job, like everybody's job in this congregation. And that is to do what God has called you to with all your heart, working heartily as to the Lord. Because Paul says it's Jesus Christ whom you are serving. And in your studies, you're not on hold. You're not on reserve. If you're a baptized Christian, you're a child of the king. And as a child of the king, you have a responsibility. And you have a responsibility to Jesus Christ. And you have a job and you have a task. And your task is to do it to the best of your ability, to do it with all your might, because you're serving Jesus Christ in your classroom, in your studies, in your homework, to this end. Look at chapter 2, cut to verse 18. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, has a dream, all right? Then Daniel went to his house, made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven. Verse 19, then the mystery was revealed to Daniel. By whom? By God. By God, in a vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven, and we have our text there, right? And then down to verse 28. Daniel goes to the king. No wise men, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show the king the mystery the king has asked. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. And he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. And then Daniel interprets the dream. And go down to verse 47. The king, as a result of that, the king answered and said to Daniel, truly, your God is God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries. Few have been able to reveal this mystery. Here's a pagan king praising God and acknowledging the God of Daniel as the one true God. Look at chapter 3, same thing. We have the golden image, right, which they are to bow down on. More of that momentarily, but they're to bow down before that. And in verse 11, whoever does not fall down in worship shall be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. Down to verse 19, of course, Daniel and his friends won't do that, right? Verse 17, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us. And then verse 19, Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury because they wouldn't do it. The expression of his face was charged against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. Down to verse 22. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those who assisted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to throw them into the fire. And these three men fell bound into the fiery furnace. And then verse 25, he answered and said, but I see four men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. A pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ preserving, protecting his people. Read down to verse 27. The hair of their heads was in sin. Their cloaks were in harm. No smell of fire had come upon them. When was the last time you were near a fireplace? Didn't even have a smoky smell on you, right? What protection God provided. Verse 28, look at the king. Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. And then verse 3 of chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar praises God. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion endures from generation to generation. Every chapter, God is the real God. A pagan king praises God and acknowledges him. Chapter 4, verse 7. Nebuchadnezzar's second dream. The magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, astrologers came in. I told them the dream, but they couldn't make known to me. It's an interpretation. And at last, Daniel came in before me. And of course, he interprets dream. Verse 24. This is the interpretation, O king. It is a decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord, the king, that you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. You shall be made to eat grass like an ox. You shall be wet with the dew of heaven. 7 periods of time shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. Verse 33. Immediately the word was fulfilled against Nebuchadnezzar. And verse 34. That's what was predicted happened, verse 34. At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing. And he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. None can stay his hand or say to him, what have you done? Chapter 5. Now we get a new king, King Belshazzar. All right. And of course, the phrase, the handwriting is on the wall, right? Comes from this chapter, all right? Maybe you know it. Verse 12. Because he had an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. Verse 18. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, kingship. Right? He raises up kings. He brings God gave him kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And then verse 22, and you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this. But you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven, and the vessels of his house have been brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives, your concubines, have drunk wine from them. You've praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, stone, which do not see or hear or know, but the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways you have not honored. Verse 26. Daniel interprets the dream. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Peretz, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then Belshazzar gave the command. Daniel was clothed with purple, a chain of gold put around his neck, and a proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed. And Darius, the Mede, received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Chapter 6, what's going to happen there? This is a lot of fun, right? This is a great book. Verse 4, Then the presidents and the satraps sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom. They could find no ground for complaint or any fault because he was faithful and no error or fault was found in him. Down to verse 10. When Daniel knew the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open towards Jerusalem. He got down on his knees three times a day so that everybody could see and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. Verse 16. Then the king commanded, and Daniel was brought and cast into the den of lions. And the king declared to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you." And a stone was brought over it. Verse 20. As he came near to the den, the king went after a night where Daniel was. He cried out in a tone of anguish. The king declared to Daniel, "O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions?" And then Daniel said to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, because I was found blameless before him. And also before you, O king, I have done no harm." The end of verse 23, because he had trusted in his God. And the king commanded, and those men who had accused Daniel were brought and cast into the den of lions, they, their children, and their wives. More on that momentarily. Now, young men, maybe you've read these stories, these Bible stories. Maybe your parents have read them. And maybe you even know that familiar song, "Dare to be a Daniel," right? "Dare to stand alone." That is not what is being communicated here. The message of Daniel is not dare to be a Daniel. Rather, but to acknowledge that God is the hero. God is the one who delivers Daniel. God is the one who reveals to him interpretations. God is the one who is faithful. God is the hero of the story. That's the message being communicated here. And then chapter 7 through 12, just quickly. God will establish a king and an everlasting kingdom in chapter 7. We'll come back to it. And then chapter 8, verse 22, the interpretation of the vision, in place of which four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, but not with his power. And in chapter 9, Daniel prays. It's a very powerful, bold prayer, but it is a covenantal prayer. Remember that I mentioned to you, in order to understand the prophets, you have to understand Deuteronomy. And if you pay a close attention to Daniel's prayer, we won't take the time to do so this morning. As Daniel is confessing his sin, he's confessing all the transgressions of the covenant. And he includes himself repeatedly, the first person plural pronoun, "we." He doesn't say, "they did it, they did it, they did it." He includes himself. Daniel is one of the few characters in the Bible about whom nothing bad is ever said. And yet here Daniel, as he prays, includes himself as a guilty sinner along with the people. Chapter 10, verse 5. We have a man clothed in linen, another pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ. He said to me, verse 12, "Fear not, Daniel, from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before God, your words have been heard, and I have come. Because of your words, God hears the prayer of his people and responds." Chapter 11, verse 31, is the abomination of desolation. And then chapter 12, verses 2 and 3, we have a resurrection. "Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. And those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the sky above. And those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever." The point being communicated is, listen, people, there's great hope for the future. Great hope for the future. Remember I said forward-looking in evil times. And as he points the people forward, it's hope that lies in the future. God's going to establish his king. God's going to establish his kingdom. God is listening. God is hearing. God is governing. God is caring. Don't lose hope. Fear not. Trust God. He's at work, even in evil times. brings us to points of application. Where do we see Christ in the book of Daniel? Well, it's so easy. You stumble over all the references to Christ. In chapter 2, he is the great stone who will crush all the other kingdoms of this world. In chapter 7, he is the Son of Man who was given dominion by the Ancient of Days. In chapter 9, verse 25, he's the coming Messiah. In chapter 10, as I noted, he is the man in linen. He is the one who is the angel in the lion's den. He's the fourth man in the furnace. We see numerous, blatant, explicit references to Jesus Christ. But that's not the gospel. How do we see the gospel in the book of Daniel? Well, as I just mentioned, in chapter 12, we have a resurrection. We see the furnace and the lion's den, which are threatening to consume and to kill Daniel, and God rescues them from that. We have Judah, which as a nation is in exile, but are promised life from the dead. But more specifically, this, the central message of Daniel, is the gospel. It's that God will rescue his people from their sin and misery. Remember, they're under the judgment of God. God will rescue his people from their sin and misery by the work of a Messiah. The righteous will be vindicated, evil will be destroyed, and the covenant blessings will prevail because Jesus will reign. All of this occurs not because humans control their fate or deserve God's redemption, but because the God of grace uses his sovereign power to maintain his covenant mercy forever. This is the gospel, according to Daniel, and should give us courage against our foes, should give us hope in our distress, and should give us perseverance in our trials. Where do we see covenant? Well, a number of places, specifically chapter 9 in Daniel's prayer. It is a covenantal prayer. It is based on the Deuteronomic prescriptions. Daniel is praying a covenantal prayer. Specifically, he's praying back to God what God had said were the characteristics of his covenant. Very interesting there. I would encourage you, if you have difficulty with prayer, as we all do, to use the scriptures to spark your prayer, to pray the scriptures back to God, to pray his promises back to him, petitioning him to keep his word, to pray his good news back to him, claiming those promises as your own. That's what Daniel is doing, specifically covenantally. But also in chapter 6, look at chapter 6. Remember we saw those who had accused Daniel? They were the ones that were brought and thrown into the lion's den, right? Remember that? But look at what it says in verse 24. They, their children, and their wives. What did their children and wives do? They weren't the ones who were railing accusations. But God deals with people covenantally. God deals with families. The Bible is not individualistic. It's covenantal. And God deals with families. And so they had accused Daniel falsely, their judge, and their families too. That's a covenantal prescription. Where do we see mission in the book of Daniel? The whole book. The whole book. What are Daniel and his friends doing repeatedly? They're witnessing to the rulers and to the people in Babylon that they serve the one true and living God, and that they're not going to eat sausage if it costs them to be unfaithful. They'll become vegans if it calls them to be faithful to God. And they're witnessing over and over again to the rulers, and Daniel is praying in public so everybody can see him. And notice specifically what the witness consists of. It's not necessarily a verbal relaying of a message, right? It's not a four-point gospel outline, but rather it's their lives, very consistent with Old Testament missionary mandate, is that they were to be, David, help me out here, centripetal? All right, Israel was to be centripetal. That is, by their lives, they were to attract the attention of the nation round about them. And that's exactly what Daniel and his friends are doing in all those six chapters. They're witnessing with their lives that God is God. God is faithful. God is in control. God is revealing interpretations. God is hearing. God is caring. God is controlling. And they do so by their lives. A few other points of application. Turn back to our text in chapter 2. Verse 20, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. And what is it specifically about the kings that we find in the book of Daniel? They're deified kings. They claim to be gods. They claim worship be rendered unto them. Now, if you're a very good student of the Bible, or if you've been sitting under this pulpit for any length of time, you know that this is a recurring theme in the Bible. And that is a deified state. From the opening book of the Bible, Genesis, with Pharaoh, through Exodus, through Babylon, through Assyria, one after another of the rulers of the earth, all the way until we get to Revelation, we have a deified state. Caesar claimed to be God, and he claimed worship was due to him alone. And if you could not say, Kurios, Caesar, Caesar is Lord, your throat was slit. And the Bible's message repeatedly, God will not tolerate a deified state. God will not tolerate kings who rob him of his glory. God will not tolerate rulers who compete with him for worship. He will bring them down. He raises kings and he sets up kings. He brought down Jehoiakim and he raised up Nebuchadnezzar. He brought down Nebuchadnezzar and raised up Belshazzar. He brought down Belshazzar and raised up Darius. He brought down Darius. He's the one. And he requires that all worship, honor, and glory be given to him. What does he say through Isaiah? I will not give my glory to another. And friends, if you think this is an abstract, past historical notion today, you're sadly mistaken. You need to open your eyes and look around you. We live in a country in which everyone looks to Uncle Sam for womb-to-tomb security, that is increasingly, almost on a daily basis, setting itself up as God. And Christians need to be the ones to say, we will not bow the knee. Look at chapter 7. Slight correction here, something which I've had occasion to point out to many people over the years. Most people take chapter 7 to be a reference to the return of Jesus Christ to set up his millennial kingdom. Remember what we said? When Christ comes back, it's the end. It's not the beginning of something else. It's the end. However, people think that when Christ returns, it's to set up a millennial kingdom because of this text. Let's read it together. Verse 9. As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, wheels burning fire. Stream of fire at issue came out. 1,000 served him, 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were open. Skip down to verse 13. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. There it is. Christ's return on the clouds. Except it's not his return. Read the next verse. He came to the Ancient of Days. Black and white, not my theology, not my interpretation, not my hermeneutic, black and white, text. What's the direction that he's traveling? Up, not down. This is a reference to Christ's ascension, the forgotten day on the Christian calendar, which is when Jesus Christ is crowned King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and where he receives his kingdom. Psalm 2, which we sang this morning, I have set my king in Zion, my holy hill, and have proclaimed to him the ends of the earth, your possession, the nations as your inheritance. This is a reference to the ascension of Jesus Christ. Isn't that what Jesus himself said in the Great Commission? All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go and claim what the Father has promised me. Make disciples of all nations. And to him was given dominion, a glory, and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. Jesus has inaugurated his kingdom. Jesus has been crowned King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Jesus has been given all authority in heaven and on earth. And Jesus has commissioned his church not on a fool's errand, but to go and make disciples of all those nations which the Father has promised to the Son as his resurrection victory. Chapter 11. Verse 31, the abomination of desolation. Here's another prophetic mile marker. However, if you're familiar with the intertestamental period, you'll know that in 167 BC, in the book of Maccabees, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, all right, it records the abomination of desolation. It's when Antiochus Epiphanes, what does Epiphanius mean? God revealed, another ruler who claimed to be God, offered a pig on the altar in the temple. And Judah Maccabee, Maccabee means the hammer, led the Maccabean revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes and cleansed the temple, from which we get the feast of Hanukkah, thank you. Feast of Dedication. By the way, if you're still witnessing to Jewish people, and you should be, the High Holy Days just went by. The only place the Feast of Hanukkah is found in the Bible is in John 10 in the New Testament. That'll get them. It's not mentioned in the Jewish Bible. Jesus observed the Feast of Dedication, the Feast of Hanukkah, which was the rededication of the temple after Antiochus Epiphanes was revolted against. So the abomination of desolation is not something exclusively that lies in the future. It's something that occurred in 167 BC. But now if you're a good Bible student, you're going to object here. You're going to push back and say, hold on. Doesn't Jesus talk about the abomination of desolation? And you're absolutely right. He does. But if it already happened in 167 BC, what's he talking about? Ah, for all you theologues, multiple fulfillment of prophecy. Ah. Chew on that for a few thousand years this afternoon. Last thing. If in fact we're headed for dark days, then let this be the takeaway from the book of Daniel. Hopefully there are many takeaways already, but let this be the last one. Refuse to compromise. Doesn't mean you don't need wisdom. We most certainly do. Doesn't mean if somebody hands you a noose, you're bound to put your neck in it. Even Jesus said, when you see, flee, right? Live to fight another day. But refused to compromise. What did we see throughout the book in the chapters of Daniel? God honors them who honor him. God honors those who honor him. Don't compromise. As you go forth this week to work, boys and girls, as you go to school, as you're in your communities with your neighbors, don't compromise. Don't chicken out. Be faithful. And God will honor you. God will hear you. God will care for you. God will protect you. Through Daniel, he's calling to you, his dearly loved people. You see me? Do you see me? Trust me. Trust me. If nothing is worth dying for, then there's nothing worth living for. Is Jesus Christ crucified, risen, and reigning on high worth dying for? Is he? You want to know why after 9/11 Islam was the fastest growing religion in America? Because people looked and they saw people that were willing to die for what they believed in. We believe in Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, reigning, and coming again. Let's live for him, no matter what. Because God's purposes will always prevail. Let's pray.